Hello, and welcome to The Real, the podcast where culture and entertainment meet. I'm your host, Mark Olson. On today's episode, Melina Matsoukas, director of Queen and Slim.
It's a beautiful love story. It's somewhat of a meditation on the Black experience about two people who are very different coming together by one very shared experience. They're a couple on a first date who is pulled over by a really racist cop on their way home and kills him in self-defense, and they go on the run and they fall in love along the way. I look to real life. I look to, you know, when Sandra Bland was pulled over and Eric Gardner was murdered, Tamir Rice was killed. You know, I look to these real occurrences in the Black community because I wanted it to feel completely authentic. And I wanted to bring in that trauma. I wanted to bring that into each frame and into the language in which these characters spoke. So I also looked into real life in that way.
That conversation is coming up a little later in the show. But first, I'm here with two of my colleagues to talk about the Golden Globe and Screen Actors Guild Award nominations from this week, Glenn Whipp and Jen Yamato. Thank you to the both of you for being here.
Woohoo!
Hey, Mark.
I want to start by talking about the Globes. I think that really the main headline coming off those nominations was that, you know, there was a lot of conversation and people were very upset. There were no female directors in the directing category, no female screenwriters in the screenwriting category. Can you talk a little bit about the sort of controversy that arose out of the nominations this week?
I don't know why people were so upset, because this is the Hollywood Foreign Press Association we're talking about. So why get that worked up about the choices of 87 barely working journalists?
Ouch.
But
Glenn with the fire.
It is the second, I guess, most watched award show. And so that matters. And I think there was certainly some thought that Little Women was going to do much better. I think the problem that I keep running into with Little Women and talking to people is that men don't want to watch this movie.
That is fascinating, because I want to hear, you have heard that anecdotally.
Yes, that they, various awards giving bodies, the people promoting, advocating for Little Women, the studio, its Oscar strategists, are having difficulty getting men to see the movie, because why do we need another Little Women? Which is like, okay, well, why do we need another Spider-Man? Why do we need another
Joker?
Why do we need another joke? Why do we need a movie about Joker? Why do we need another James Bond movie? It's interesting that those questions aren't more asked, and then you make a movie, really the first major adaptation of Little Women in 25 years, so more than a generation goes by, and people are asking, well, why do we need another Little Women?
But we're not just talking about Little Women. We're also talking about A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, talking about Hustlers, The Farewell, Honey Boy. There was a whole list of female-directed films or female-written films that could have been included in the Globes and even to some extent in the SAG nominations. Now, Jen, on Monday when the Globe nominations came out, the response was quite swift, and it was from some of those filmmakers themselves, specifically Honey Boy director Alma Harrell. What do you make of the way that that sort of response happens so quickly now?
Well, Alma Harrell, who directed Honey Boy, which is the autobiographical film written by and starring Shia LaBeouf, which is excellent, she is also a big vocal and public advocate for the hiring of female and underrepresented talent. She launched a platform this year called Free the Work, which coincides, I think, with, I think, a greater lens, an even greater amplification of ways to actively get more representation behind the camera. So she's very vocal, and I'm so happy for it, because she tweeted some very strong thoughts about the Golden Globe nominations that were echoing what a lot of people were feeling in a year with so many excellent films made by women.
Well, one thing that I thought was very interesting this year with the Golden Globes from the Hollywood Foreign Press Association is that they have, as all awards-giving bodies must, some very wonky and specific rules regarding their foreign language nominations in particular, and how foreign language films can compete in other categories.
Oh, it's so frustrating.
And they, this year in particular, with Parasite, with Pedro Almodovar's Pain and Glory, and really a big controversy about Lulu Wang's The Farewell, which is every inch an American film and yet is nominated in the Best Foreign Language category. What do you make of the fact that the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, which you would think would be the sort of most international and cosmopolitan of awards-giving bodies, actually has these very strange and sort of stringent rules about what goes where?
Yeah, I think it's something that they should take a second look at 78 years into their existence, maybe. Maybe next year, in the 78th year, they can kind of, yeah, you would think, I always emphasize that it's the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, and yet they're not really advocates for international cinema.
The Farewell is not an international film. That's an American film.
That's the ridiculous thing.
With the Globes in particular, for their Best Picture, both comedy and drama. So across 10 nominees there, 4 of those titles, I believe, are Netflix movies. Jen, that's a big move for Netflix.
Honestly, I think it's just what we're going to get more and more used to. And there are plenty of people who were resistant to that in the industry, especially after Netflix scored so big with Roma. But by this year, it just seems normal to me. I'm already here for it.
Even with the muscle that Netflix obviously has, on the TV side, Ava DuVernay's When They See Us, completely blanked by the Globes, got zero nominations.
I mean, it was one of the most glaring omissions to me in their slate of nominations.
Really glaring to me. I think the best, I don't know, silver lining to come out of any sort of snub, these are the titles and people that were snubbed out of X award show, is that deserving projects get renewed attention. And especially on social media, I think we've saw, especially with When They See Us, you know, it can bring a wider audience to revisiting or visiting for the first time that project. And I think that's maybe the only, you know, upside to it.
I mean, the thing that gets me angry about some of these, and I try not to, it's just awards. Come on, let's have some perspective. But
you're not getting in Twitter fights every day about
So, like, we bring attention to these things. And say, you know, when the Oscars roll around, say The Farewell and Little Women show up as they should, as we believe they should. Then you're going to hear a bunch of people say, the Motion Picture Academy, it's tokenism. They're just rewarding. They're just meeting quotas. That makes me angry because it's not. In advance, I'm already, you know, shaking my fist at it.
Before we wrap up, I must say there is one huge, huge omission to all of these awards so far, and that is Cats. Where are Cats?
So the motion picture, Jen brings up a very good point. The motion picture Cats, directed by Tom Hooper, it got one nomination from the Golden Globes.
For Best Song.
Can you
written by Andrew Lloyd Webber
and
Taylor Swift.
Come on, Jen.
And it was screened for The Good People of the Globes, has not been screened for other groups, say, for example, critics groups. And so it kind of is this odd, you know, mystery of the universe right now. What's going on with Cats?
Well, look, if we look at the Golden Globes as any kind of tea leaves, it is, what does it mean that Globes members saw some version, unfinished version of Cats, saw enough to nominate the Taylor Swift, Andrew Lloyd Webber song, but did not think it was deserving of any other nomination? What does that tell us?
Including Best Musical or Comedy. The category.
I think it's sad. I kind of miss the old HFPA who would just like fall head over heels with a movie like Cats.
Anyway, Cats does open this big question for me, which is, who are the HFPA? I mean, there's only 87 of them. Let's sit down with each and every one of them to explain to me why no more Cats nominations.
Let's bring them in next week. We're going to have to get a few more chairs in the room. I'm sure, Mark, you can handle that, right?
Well, we'll keep our eye on the Globes nominations as we move towards the ceremony in January. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
And now, it's time for Glenn Whip's Awards Minute.
Now, I really wanted to talk a little bit more about this, but I didn't have a chance on the panel. And that's obviously my obsession with the movie Parasite. You know, this time last year, we were thinking, okay, could Roma, a foreign language film, win Best Picture? On this day last year, Roma did not receive a SAG Awards Ensemble nomination. the great thing about this year is that movie that I love and revere, and it's my favorite movie of the year, Parasite, did, somewhat surprisingly, receive a nomination for Best Movie Ensemble. And that has only happened one other time in the history of the SAG Awards, and that was for Roberto Benigni's Life is Beautiful. And whatever you think about that film, the fact that Parasite made it in for the SAG Awards Ensemble is huge, and it continues the momentum for this movie, which premiered at Cannes, was beloved at the Toronto Film Festival, beloved at Telluride Film Festival, has been sweeping through critics groups prizes, and critics do not give the Oscars, but critics can influence the Oscars. And all these things taken together, there is a separate category for foreign language films, so I'm still a realist, but I'm starting to get just a little bit more optimistic about the possibility, just the possibility, that Parasite could win the Oscar for Best Picture.
As we said, despite what the Golden Globe nominations may reflect, it has been a very strong year for female filmmakers and inclusion in front of and behind the camera. And it just so happens we have an interview this week with director Melina Matsoukas, who made her feature debut with Queen and Slim, the new film starring Daniel Kaluuya and Jodie Turner-Smith. Melina, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I feel like you're going to do this much better than I would. How do you describe Queen and Slim to people? What's kind of the elevator pitch version of the movie?
I would say Queen and Slim is a beautiful love story. It's somewhat of a meditation on the Black experience. It's about two people who are very different coming together by one very shared experience. They're a couple on a first date who is pulled over by a really racist cop on their way home and kills him in self-defense, and they go on the run and they fall in love along the way.
When the movie begins, it is with this very sweet, it's this kind of very awkward, kind of bad first date. And then the movie really starts to take this series of shifts, both tonally and even visually. What was it that you liked about having the movie have that kind of structure?
Exactly that. I felt like it really spoke to all the different aspects of who I am as an artist, but more so as a person. I don't really live in one space, I feel like, artistically, and I need all these different elements to feed me and feed my soul. And I love how Lena was really able to straddle the lines and blur the lines between mediums. Like, it definitely starts out as somewhat of a rom-com when these two people meet in the diner and they're just not really getting on, and quickly shifts into somewhat of a horror story as they're pulled over by the cop, and then an immense and beautiful, powerful love story that also, you know, uses comedy throughout, you know, for comic relief and also as a way to deal with trauma, you know, and I believe strongly in that. So I love how she was able to blur the lines, and I tried to visually mirror that kind of dance between genres.
You and Lena had previously collaborated on the Thanksgiving episode of Master of None, and is that kind of where this project began? Like, did it sort of spring from when you worked together on that episode?
I think for her, so it did. We came together on Master of None. We did the Thanksgiving episode, which is about her coming out as a Black lesbian to her mother. And that was something so special that I knew I had to be a part of that historical moment. We had never seen that on television before. And immediately, our working relationship was so full of trust and love and empowerment that I knew we would continue it, hopefully, for a lifetime. And while we were shooting that, she was working on Queen and Slim, and she asked if I would direct it, and I immediately told her no, because I don't like to agree to projects because of my relationships. I like to commit to things that I feel passionately about. I wanted to be moved by the script, and I was in every way. I couldn't put that script down, and I really fell in love with her words and her poetry, you know, and so I agreed to do the film after I read it, and so we are here.
And if you said no at first, what changed your mind?
I didn't say no. I just said, let me read it. You know, I didn't want to agree to anything before I knew I loved it, you know, and I knew I already loved her. I just didn't want that, again, to dictate what I committed to myself to artistically. I wanted the words to really pull me in, and they did.
And then what was the sort of the collaboration like between the two of you once you were making the movie? I mean, were you sort of visualizing to what she had written, or was it less of a one-way street than that? Was she ever writing to, like, ideas that you had?
Yeah, absolutely. I think our relationship is full of this incredible trust. We love to challenge each other, you know, and there's also this incredible honesty between us where we can say what we like and what we don't. And, you know, I read the script and I had a lot, you know, I loved it, but I also had a lot of issues with it. And we sat down and, you know, we talked about it page by page, literally, and draft after draft, you know, and she's receptive to some and not others, and rightfully so. You know, she also is really strong in her opinion. But I feel like in the end, you kind of get the best of us. And so we developed the script together. She is, you know, like one of the things was like the ending. You know, I wanted it to be a little more complicated and dig a little deeper, and I didn't want it to be easy. And she loves a challenge, you know, so she's really great with hearing issues, and I'm really good at giving them, but not necessarily a solution. And so she can take that and walk away and listen. She's a really good listener as well, and kind of put together all the things in my head and make them make sense and translate them into words, because that's definitely not my talent. We worked together, and I felt like we got the script into a really strong place, and we sold it, and then she pretty much handed it over. And I was able to breathe life into it and to give it a soul and to give it a visual language and to figure out how to mirror her script visually without having to depend on the dialogue. You know, that's kind of how I approach filmmaking. And that's the really, you know, the fun part for me, you know, as a director. And she's really trusting in that. In the same way that I say, you know, I'm not a writer, she feels she's not a director. And we have immense respect for each other and each other's lanes and each other's talent. We're never afraid to be honest and to challenge each other either. So I think, again, you get the best of both worlds.
Because I don't know how to put this, but Queen and Slim is a mood. Like, or more specifically, I think it's like a series of moods. And I know for myself, I found the ending of the movie, it took me to a place that I was very moved by the ending in ways that I wasn't expecting from sort of like what had come before in the movie. And do you feel like for yourself that that sort of control of tone and mood, does that come from, you think, your music video background? Or where for you does that come from?
I think it comes from my life, you know? I've always been attracted to things that don't live in one space. I don't feel like I'm a person that lives in one box. I'm not defined by any one genre. And I kind of like it all, you know? Like, I'll say I'm a clown one minute and then I'm a drama queen another, you know? And I kind of need all of these things to be myself. I'm very comfortable jumping between all of these genres and all of these tones because that's the language that I speak. And I think that's honestly true to life. I don't think anybody really lives in one space all the time.
Where do like the visual ideas for the movie come from? Are you using, is it other movies? Are there photographers? What sort of like references are you pulling from?
Yeah, kind of everything, you know, definitely my life and my experiences. I think are the first thing that informs you, whether it's consciously or not. Just naming some of the things that I look to, the work of Hype Williams is who I call the godfather of Black cinema. He really created and carved a visual language for me and our whole generation. I look to his film Belly a lot in all of my work, and I think there's a couple instances there you really see it. So he's one. When I was thinking about shooting a car movie, like I wanted to look at other car trips, that films that I really enjoyed, and Y Tu Mamá También is one of my favorites. I love how they approach the shooting of the car and those scenes. And sometimes we're inside and we're another character. And sometimes we're really outside and witnessing it and the dialogue as the characters witness the landscape. And it's never repetitive. So that was really important to me. That and Taxi Driver, I think, for how to shoot this tiny space, you know, where you're going to have to return to and make it feel different and make it interesting. Those two were the films that I looked to for the car stuff. There's this amazing photographer, Bernie Imes, who had shot the Black South and also Juke Joints around in and of the South. And I looked to him for a lot of, for obviously our Juke Joint scene, but also some of the Americana scene, the Americana iconography in the South. So his photography, Dina Lawson is another one of my favorite photographers who was able to shoot people in their own homes with their things, and she brings in something that to juxtapose against their own belongings to tell that story of who these people are and the history of who they are. So I look to her work a lot as well. And then honestly, YouTube. I look to real life. I look to, you know, when Sandra Bland was pulled over and Eric Gardner was murdered, Tamir Rice was killed. You know, I look to these real occurrences in the Black community because I wanted it to feel completely authentic. And I knew that was pertinent for that scene to be powerful and to have resonance. And I wanted to bring in that trauma. I wanted to bring that into each frame and into the language in which these characters spoke. So I also looked into real life in that way.
What do you do to kind of bring all these separate influences together?
I mean, it starts kind of with like just this, you know, stream of consciousness where I just pull everything. And then I try to make it make sense. And then as I'm traveling and I'm I'm location scouting and I'm getting inspired, then I start giving it a language. And I did, in the end, create exactly that, a lookbook. Me and my production designer, we worked on it together, and she's pulling stuff. And even from real life, as we're looking at one location that we might not shoot at, but we'll be like, oh, I really like whatever, this art on the wall, or the lock on the door, or this color of paint, or how it's peeling. You know, we'll kind of take from real life as well and remember that and maybe mimic it and wherever we end up. But we created a lookbook. We created a very narrative-based one that took you from each scene to the next, that had our references and our real locations in it. So you kind of can see their journey before you begin shooting. And that's something that I would share with all my key crew, so they also could understand the visual language and what we were trying to achieve when we started.
Because you mentioned the juke joint scene in the movie, and that's really one of my favorite sequences in the film, because in some ways it's the most sort of like sexy and sort of sensual scenes in the film, but it also has this real sense of danger about it. I mean, with sort of where it is in the narrative, mm-hmm. at that point, Queen and Slim are, you know, they're fugitives on the run. They've been on the news. They're afraid that people know who they are. Mm-hmm. And tell me how a scene like that comes together.
Well, I've always thought of Queen and Slim's journey as a reverse slave escape narrative, right? They start in the north and they end up south, so they're going the whole opposite way. And that was also why we started in Cleveland, because Cleveland was the last stop on the Underground Railroad before slaves would get to Canada. And also it was where Tamir Rice was killed. So it was important that we started in Cleveland, and true to her story, because they have the death penalty. And I wanted it to start out cool in terms of tone and color, and as their relationship warms up, literally the world around them warms up and becomes more vibrant. And so when they make it to the juke joint, it's somewhat of another stop on the Underground Railroad for them. It's a safe haven, which it actually is, right? It's called the Underground as well. If you see, there's a little sketch on the wall outside where I named it. But, you know, everybody in there is really protecting them and protecting their love for each other, and letting them have this moment where they can kind of become undone to each other and fall in love in the middle of this crazy, tense journey. When I'm shooting it and thinking of, like, I want these two people to connect in this way where the world kind of around them falls away and they're just, like, caught in their own bubble for this one moment, I also look to West Side Story. And this is one of my favorite films, and I can sing and recite the whole thing. You don't want to hear that. But I remember when Tony saw Maria in the gym for the first time, and they were, like, at this dance, right? And they used some, like, very odd filter now, but everything got, like, really out of focus except for them. And I wanted that same tone so you could feel it, and that vibrancy, right, of the world that they were in. So I knew, like, color wise and we had Little Freddie King, who's this amazing blues singer, to set the tone. And we had all generations of people, because that's what it really feels like when you're in a small town and there's a juke joint. There's, like, one place to go out to and everybody comes. And so that was kind of the mood. And I wanted a lot of shadows because I wanted them to see each other through the darkness and for it to feel sexy and hot and sweaty. And it was, and we were also in New Orleans, so that part was easy. But yeah, and then they get lost in this moment, and then in post, I remember not wanting it to feel, like, completely straightforward, and I added this voiceover that as they're dancing and the camera's dancing around with them, and they're falling in love, you literally can feel and hear that moment, because she's talking about what she wants in a man, and it's a dialogue from the next scene was meant to be in the next scene, and I just laid it over that scene with this really quiet moment. So you felt like you were in her head and in her perspective as she's literally falling in love with this man that she's dancing with.
It's very much rooted in this very real situation of this couple on the run, this sense of sort of a political climate. But then there is something that's, like, not naturalistic, that's almost surreal about the film in a way. Are those two feelings opposite? Like, you know, a lot of times I feel like there are things happening in the movie that shouldn't go together, right, but somehow they're going together.
I think it goes back to that, like, bending genre, right? And also mimicking real life. I wanted it to feel how it feels when you fall in love and when you really meet your soulmate. And for me, that's, you know, it's fantastical in so many ways. It's a fantasy. It's surreal. And so I wanted these moments where they were really heightened and it felt stylized and you felt like you were in your head, right? Like, you literally put on blinders sometimes when you're in love. And I wanted to have those moments as well as the really raw, like, documentary style, like, authenticity that I feel like life is. You know, I wanted it to kind of mirror our natural emotions more so than the, like, literal way we walk through life.
You did an interview with my colleague Sanaya Kelly here at the Times where you talked about how people use Bonnie and Clyde as, like, the most, that's the thing people are reaching to first to describe the movie. And you don't really prefer that.
I do not agree with it.
Well, tell me more about that. Like, what is it you don't like about Bonnie and Clyde as a reference? And maybe is there something you'd rather people use as a reference?
Well, first, I feel like I don't like when black films are based on some white archetype. You know, it's like we can never just be ourselves. We always have to be compared to something else in order for it to make sense. And right, it can just make sense because that's who we are and that's our culture. So I don't like trying to box it in some way. Also, Bonnie and Clyde were criminals and Queen and Slim are very much not. You know, they didn't choose that and they've also taken control of their fate, but they haven't done anything wrong, depending on who you ask. But if you ask me, they've done nothing wrong and they're heroes. You know, they're not robbers. So that's obviously a huge difference between them. And I don't know. I don't know. For me, there is no way to describe Queen and Slim besides themselves. They just are. They're Queen and Slim.
We talked before, and I'd heard you say that you have kind of gotten pretty involved in the advertising, the marketing for the film. Mm-hmm. For a first-time filmmaker, that sounds to me, that seems unusual. And for you, what makes you want to kind of be involved in being sure that the narrative is what you want it to be?
Yeah, I mean, it's really important for me as a filmmaker that everything involved in pushing the film is part true to our narrative as a film and to Lena and I as filmmakers. You know, I am not really comfortable in this space, like this space right now where I have to be in front of the film and explain what's going on and doing press. It's not something I'm comfortable with. And so if I have to stand in front of it, I have to really believe in it. And if I believe in it, then it has to be mine. I have to have ownership of that. And, you know, Make Ready, who's the company who financed our film, and Universal is distributing our film. They've been incredible supporters in that, like really empowering female voice to take control of her narrative. And yeah, it's just who I am and I can't be anybody else. And sadly, I wish I could hand that over sometimes and give up that control. But I think that's also what makes me myself.
But what is that attention to detail, not just in the advertising, but I mean, in the movie itself? I mean, you talked about a little sign or like the paint on the wall. What does that kind of attention to detail mean to you?
I mean, it's all part of story. You know, I come from music videos where there's no script. There's no script to depend on and we have to tell a story visually. You know, I went to grad school for cinematography. And not that I ever wanted to shoot, but as a director, I really wanted to be informed about my craft and learn how to tell a story visually. And so I learned that the mise-en-scene and all these details in which you approach a narrative are pushing that story forward. You know, like one of the things I added to Queen and Slim from the top is that, you know, when we meet Queen and Slim, he's praying over his food and she's like in this awkward silence, like wanting to interrupt him. And right away, that establishes who they are and their fundamental differences as two people. But I really believe in the power of the details to inform you about characters, to inform you about story, to let you understand like who these people are at this exact time and place, and to really depend on that to be able to tell the story.
That sense of detail and control, do you feel like that's something you've seen in some of the other people you've worked with on music videos? I mean, obviously, I'm thinking of Beyonce, Rihanna. I mean, those are people that seem in control of every piece of what goes out in the world.
Absolutely. I mean, when I collaborate with those women, I make sure that it's on brand, which is also like why I think I am involved in the marketing and advertising. It's what I come from. I've always been pushing someone else's brand or their influences or what they believe in. This is the first time that I feel like something has really come from me, right? And I'm not in charge of, I don't have the responsibility of living up to someone else's story, and this can be my own. So that's actually a really freeing space to be in now. But I also enjoy that. I love the collaboration between artists. I love pushing someone's brand, if I believe in them, forward. And I understand the importance of that for an artist, that they have to really believe in what they're representing, right? Because otherwise you won't get the best of them and you won't really understand who they are. So I believe strongly in that. I would never, you know, do something that somebody is against if they are the ones at the forefront. It's the same with me. And yeah, I think that attention to detail definitely comes from that. It's also like working with Beyonce, who has complete control of her narrative and is really, she was the first. She was the first one as a black woman artist to have that control, to own her image and to put in the work into all of what you see. Like she's really making sure that it stays true to her voice. And it was a huge inspiration to me to know that you can take that control. Because sometimes we don't take it. We don't ask. We don't even know that we can, right? And I'm just like, it's not a question for me now because of where I come from.
You are a first-time feature filmmaker, but you have all this experience with music videos, commercials on episodic television. What were you most surprised by in making your first feature film?
Yeah, it was a war. I was surprised by how difficult it was. And I know that filmmaking is difficult. It's never easy, honestly. Like, you know, they're all, I think, different fights. But this one was extremely challenging. And I think it had to be because of who we were honoring and what we were trying to say. It was a very serious film. You know, it wasn't fun and games. It wasn't like a lot of laughing. And and those that joy on set. It was very serious, and we took what we were, who we were honoring and the story we were trying to tell with, you know, immense respect for those who had been sacrificed to police brutality, and we wanted to honor them. So yeah, it was surprising about how difficult the process was. I was not expecting that. But beyond that, it was, I think everything else kind of fell in line.
So it is a movie from a major Hollywood studio telling this very specific story in a very specific way, created by two women of color. In and of itself, that sounds like quite an accomplishment. Like something would be very difficult to get done. When you say it was difficult, what was the challenge in just getting in the door in the first place and getting it started? Or like, where did that biggest challenge come from?
I mean, yeah, you could say the challenge was even getting there. You know, like I had been discredited as a director because I come from music videos for many years. I've been doing this since 2005 and putting in the work, and I wasn't even looked at as a true auteur until very recently because I come from music videos, which I feel like people look down upon in our industry when really they're experimental films. And so, like, just being able to get to this point in my career has been a fight, very difficult. Meeting someone like Lena, a true collaborator, that's really hard to find and navigate. And I'm really sensitive to how special the bond that we have is. Having a partner that is so invested in the fight with you, you know, and is a real collaborator, not just on screen, but behind the camera and every step of the way. We both produced, and she obviously wrote and directed the film, but we're both producers on the film. And yeah, I think to get it made, we were given great opportunities. Make Ready was there from the beginning. They were really excited about this kind of film with the new voice and us as new filmmakers in this landscape.
And now in having Jodie Turner-Smith in co-lead in the film, this is her first starring role. And then also you had told me how you'd gotten a number of young photographers to come to set to kind of give them an opportunity. It's striking to me that for you as someone, this is your first feature film, and yet you're still looking to use the platform that you have to help other people along the way. Is that difficult for you to keep in mind? Because in some ways I would think, like, as a first-time filmmaker, you're just like worried about defending the turf you have, not necessarily in like lending a hand to somebody else.
It's definitely not lending a hand. I would call it an honor. It was an honor to have that opportunity to give a platform to diverse voices and to artists that I respect. Jodie is immense. She's an immense talent. And we knew we wanted to broaden the landscape. We knew we wanted to create a new opportunity for a new actress because we were given that. And we wanted to have that diversity that we look to as people of color in this industry is so needed. And there's so many artists and so much talent that is unseen. And so we just wanted to broaden our light in many ways. And also it was somewhat selfish and indulgent in that I'm a fan of all of these people's work as well. And I just wanted to be a witness to it and to know that we could collaborate on my film. It's an incredible feeling.
I've heard you talk about the movie and the phrase legacy. And it's even, I think it's the tagline of the film is, "Can I be your legacy?" What does that mean? What does that mean to you in relation to the story of Queen and Slim?
It means, like, what do you want to be left with? What change do you want to create? How do you want to be remembered and known? And what do you want to be known for? And, you know, I think that Queen and Slim will be known to be fighters. And I think that's what they represent, definitely for me. And I hope that I can continue in that legacy in some way.
The movie is Queen and Slim. Melina Matsoukas, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. That was exciting.
That's it for this week's show. Thanks to our producer, Paige Heimson, and our audio engineer, Mike Heflin. Subscribe to The Real on Apple, Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you like what you hear, please give us a 5-star review. You can also visit us at latimes.com/The Real.